To talk about something very important, that we need someone to record. Please run and grab other people with you on the way. So if someone ever asks about the rabbi's classes, so this is SoundCloud, then they have to follow my note.
Right. Okay, great.
I just discovered the SoundCloud today.
The app?
Yeah. It's really good. That's really good, because I wanted to share like with my friends certain things, and it just took ages for me to explain. Instead, I could just listen.
Send them the link.
Yes.
Oh, Carissa is here. Oh,
hello.
Unbelievable.
Grab my sweatshirt.
Okay. What else we want to share with the rabbi? We have a few questions over here. Who had a halachic question? Gabriella, you had a halachic question?
Stephanie,
what
happened? No, I think I'm good right now.
Okay. Also, there's a girl leaving. There's a girl leaving Matzah Shabbos. She'll have to fast like
extra 3 hours.
Yeah, I don't know how. It's she'll have to because she's flying all the way to California.
Yeah.
So that is also an interesting topic that came up, but she's not in class now.
Okay. They can always email me. Okay, hi everybody. Again, I hope the summer session is going well for you.
Should I turn on the...
If that's okay, yeah. So, yeah,
please. The rabbi is
effort. Again, the schedule for some reason came out that I don't get to teach you that much, so it's only the second class, but again, I hope everything else is going very well. A few things. I understand that you heard a lecture on organ donation from Robbie Berman, who's a very, very fine person, the head of the Halachic Organ Donor Society, HODES. And hopefully you can look at his website, which is a very comprehensive website. And I myself have some articles on that website. But I think there was a bit of a concern that he was only presenting a certain position, which he holds very, very strongly. And I just want to give you a complete picture, which unfortunately means things are a bit more complicated, perhaps, than was presented. And therefore, one cannot at all conclude that organ donation is proper, although obviously it accomplishes many, many good things. So I hate to kind of do that. I normally would not do that. Somebody gives a share, they give a share, and that's their share. But I was specifically asked by Levinger and by some other people to fill it in. So I don't mean to cast aspersions on anyone. He acts only out of the most noble motives. But he does have an agenda, albeit an agenda for good purposes, but he does have an agenda. And as a result, you did not get the entire picture. So let me say, I don't think I'll have to take up the whole time. I just wanted to give you some basic ideas. First, I would like to divide organ donation into three categories. Category number one is live organ donation. That simply means you donate an organ when you're still alive and you're not going to die as a result. Now, a lot of organs you can't give that way. You can't give a heart as a live donor. But you can give a kidney, simply because people can live with one kidney. You can actually give a partial liver transplant, because the liver can regenerate with as little as 20% of a liver. So it's entirely possible for me to give half of my liver to somebody. And there is even partial lung transplants. Portions of a lung can be removed and the like. So let's first focus on that. Are there any halachic problems with my deciding to donate a kidney or donate part of my liver or donate a lung? So here, the bottom line is that there are no prohibitions involved at all. In fact, it is a great mitzvah if you can save somebody's life by donating an organ. But the only thing is, you're not obligated to do so. And the reason why you're not obligated to do so is that whenever you donate an organ, you're putting yourself at a certain risk of danger. For example, if you donate a kidney, there is a greater risk of an overstress on another kidney, on the remaining kidney. And the halachic principle is that although it's a great, great mitzvah to save somebody's life, you don't have to save somebody's life at the risk of putting your own life in potential danger. So our bottom line about live organ, not dead organ, live organ donors is, it is a great mitzvah to do it, but it can only be a voluntary act. It is not an obligation. There are certain types of mitzvot which are mitzvot if you do them, but there's not an obligation on your part to do them. Now, this has some very interesting implications. Because once we move it from the category away from an obligation into something that's meritorious but a non-obligation, you have to balance it against other things. So for example, if a mother with young children decides to be a kidney donor, for the most part, I'm not saying for sure, but for the most part we would discourage her. Because once again, there are so many responsibilities towards other people that depend on her, and one should not, in their zeal to help somebody else, do something that may leave their children in a dangerous state. On the other hand, if you're single and unattached, maybe the balance would cut the other way, meaning it's a very individualized decision. Obviously, it depends even medically on how healthy you are and everything else, but you have to weigh other commitments that you have. You can't simply say, this is a good deed, I want to do it. You have to look at the impact it will have on other relationships that you have. So that's a very important point. Now, there's another point that's interesting. This was an actual decision in Israel around, I think, 15 years ago. Imagine this. This was an actual case. A teenage boy, I don't remember the exact ages, so I'm going to make up some numbers, but let's say a teenage boy, 18 years old, needs a kidney transplant. Otherwise, he'll die. There are no compatible kidney donors, etc. Dialysis can only work for a certain amount of time. There is no genetically compatible donor. We know that the big problem with all organ donations is that the body's immune system rejects any type of foreign substance. And that's a wonderful thing. That's how we fight disease, but that also means organs from another source routinely get rejected. And that is why all organ donations require very extreme dosages of anti-rejection drugs, which can be themselves very dangerous because it compromises your immune system. So if somebody sneezes in the room, you know, you could die from that alone. Just the germs of a routine sneeze and the like. Okay, we'll come back to that. The only compatible donor for this 18-year-old was his younger brother, who was 11. The 11-year-old wanted to donate, and the parents wanted to donate. But the halachic determination was that we cannot take organs from a minor. What is the logic? Because since organ donation is not mandatory, it is optional, it can only be done with the informed consent of the donor. If it would be a mitzvah, we would do it because it's a mitzvah, but if it's not a mitzvah, it has to be a voluntary decision. And a minor is not capable of making a mature decision. Now you may say, but wait a second, it's not just the minor, it's the parents. But no, parents can make medical decisions for the benefit of a minor, but they can't make a medical decision putting the minor at risk in order to save another child. So the child cannot consent because he is a minor, and the parents cannot consent because this is not for the benefit of the child, this is for the benefit of another child. Net result, the minor was not allowed to be a donor, and I believe the very unhappy, tragic story was that the older sibling died. Now, if you're going to say, oh, this is harsh and mean and halacha is so no negative, let me point out that at least in the United States, the law would work the same way. As a matter of secular law, we do not take organs from minors. And not only that, but remember that the age of majority in the United States is 18. The age of majority in halacha is 13 for a boy and 12 for a girl. So as a matter of fact, halacha would have taken an organ from a 13-year-old when American law would not. It's very, very interesting. Okay, now, let me give you another case and see if you can see the difference. This was an actual case that also happened around... Huh? Didn't hear. Sorry?
But is that when you're 16, you put, like...
Well, you get a driver's license when you're 16, but they don't necessarily
but
take
you
an organ.
You put in it that you're an organ donor.
Well, that's fine, but that assumes you'll get into an accident at 18. In other words, if you actually get into an accident at 16, they may not take the organ. But you're doing it so that if it happens after 18, you have a consent that they will consider because you didn't revoke it. Okay. Anyway, I think in New York is the age of driving 18? Is that true in New York?
Right.
I know in Connecticut it was 16. Yeah.
I think over the nation is okay to minor. I know cases where.
Oh yeah. Please keep in mind. You're 100% correct. No, you're 100% correct. Actually, you're right. You're right. You are right. I was confusing it. Remember? Yeah. I'm confusing and be sure that you understand. Right now we are talking about live organ donors.
Right, that's what I just
said. Yeah, that's right. That's a very good point. I'm talking about live organ donors because the problem is a live donor is assuming a risk. A dead donor is not assuming a risk. They're already dead. That's why there would be a difference. Now, consider this case, and this did not involve Jewish people, but it could have involved Jewish people, and see what it's like. This is the famous Ayala case that also became a book and a movie. This involved a teenage girl that had leukemia. She needed a bone marrow transplant. There are extensive bone marrow registries, but again, there was no compatible donor. Her parents were not compatible. So mom and dad had this great idea. Let's try to have another kid. And maybe the baby, will be a bone marrow donor. Now, this is quite an amazing story because dad already had a vasectomy, which would have to be surgically reversed at only a 40% rate of success. Mom was undergoing chemotherapy for breast cancer, and she could not get pregnant until she went into remission, and the poisonous drugs were flushed out of her system. Mom was also above 40, so the chances of a pregnancy go way down anyway. And what are the chances? If neither parent is a donor, who says the kid's going to be a donor? But God looked favorably at this family. Vasectomy was surgically successfully reversed. Mom went into remission. She was able to get the chemotherapy drugs out of her system. They got pregnant naturally. It wasn't even an IVF. And the miracle baby, Marissa, was a 100% compatible donor for older sister Anissa. And they were able to take bone marrow from a newborn baby and give it to the older sister. And Baruch Hashem, both were doing well after more than 10 years. Now, at the time, all the news magazines were raising the ethical questions of conceiving a child to be a marrow donor. And again, it's very strange what becomes an ethical problem in the United States, because if there would just be an abortion, abortion does not raise ethical issues, but somehow getting bone marrow from a child does. But okay, but now, this is a beautiful story, although somebody told me recently the sister that was a donor brought a lawsuit against her parents for invading her body without her consent. So I guess everything turns into a lawsuit eventually. But okay.
Second born child or the one that was receiving?
No. The one that received it was very happy. She's alive.
But
the
also the parent?
The donor. The one that was the baby because she said her body was invaded without her consent. But okay.
What age was she suing?
She was newborn baby.
What age was she?
Now she's 20. She's 20 years old now.
So she sued at age 20 her parents?
Yeah, she's suing at 20. She's suing her parents for what they did when she was born. Okay, maybe she went to law. Why is she doing it now? I don't know. Maybe she went to law school and figured, this is what happens. But my question is this: I just told you that there was a halachic ruling that we don't take kidneys from 11-year-olds. So here's my question: if the Ayala case would have happened with a religious Jewish family, if we don't take kidneys from an 11-year-old, could we take bone marrow from a newborn baby? I mean, don't you have the same problem that there's no informed consent because this is a newborn baby, obviously? I mean, an 11-year-old at least said, I want. Here you have a baby. The baby is acted upon.
But maybe it's not a risk. I mean, it's pain, but it's not a risk.
Right, so that is halachically very, very crucial. And that is the idea that we don't compel donations from minors is based on the notion that giving up a vital organ does significantly create risk. And therefore, it is not within parental authorization to impose a risk on one child in order to save another child. Right? That's the predicate of the halachic principle. Bone marrow is not the same as a kidney. Bone marrow does not pose any significant risk. There is a certain amount of pain, obviously. And although it's under anesthesia, of course, anesthesia itself has a certain risk of danger, particularly for a young baby where you give a little too much, and you know that could be fatal. But overall, it's a very, very small risk, and therefore halacha would differentiate between surgical procedures that are virtually, nothing is risk-free, but virtually risk-free, albeit with some amount of pain, versus procedures like giving up a vital organ, which do create a risk of kidney failure and the like. So therefore, halacha might differentiate. By the way, even in the case of the kidney, I believe that it could have been decided a different way, because one could say the following. One could say that allowing a younger brother to donate an organ to an older brother is not only for the benefit of the older brother, it is also for the benefit of the younger brother. And this is true in two different ways. And the most basic way, it gives the younger brother a sibling, a brother. That's important. That could be a lifetime partner, a lifetime friend. But number two, I can't help but think there's a tremendous amount of undeserved but real psychological guilt. If a kid goes through life with the realization that he could have saved his brother and he did not, although he wanted to and they didn't let him, he's going to feel in some way. And again, it's undeserved. I'm not saying he should. Well, that's interesting. Mental anguish. He's going to feel. Now, again, I'm not suggesting at all he should feel that way. But I think practically, the person's going to feel that he is responsible for his brother's death. So if I would have been the rabbi, you know, I would have, I think, allowed it with the same conceptual structure. In other words, I agree with the conceptual structure that parents cannot endanger one child to save another child. We accept that. But the argument would be that saving the other child is also for the benefit of this child. It is not simply an altruistic gesture. But be it as it may, that's kind of what you need to know for live organ donations. Now, I know that was not Rabbi Berman's main talk. I'll get to the other aspect in a moment. But for live organ donations, bottom line is, it's a great mitzvah if you're able to do it, but you are not obligated to do it because you don't have to put yourself in danger to save other people. Yeah.
Is blood included in that? Like, if our school has a blood drive and we're like healthy, we should.
I think that is so. I think very much that is so, because if anything, blood is far less onerous than even bone marrow. You know, blood, you might be tired for a few hours, and that's about it, and the pain is minimal. Bone marrow is actually the pain might be relatively significant. Now, there is an issue here, though. Maybe I'll just address, because it is a very delicate issue, and that is the issue of our responsibility to non-Jews. That is a tricky issue, because there are some opinions that actually say that you should not give blood or bone marrow if it's going to go to non-Jews as opposed to Jews. So you will hear that decision that some make. Other poskim say no, the mitzvah of saving life will apply in all cases. So that's the only qualification I would give. But absolutely, if it's a Jewish drive, or there's a drive in Israel, there's no question that people should participate in it. And in fact, it's very, very... In other words, I don't really understand myself why sometimes participation for blood drives is a relatively low percentage. I mean, you can potentially save a life. It's at no risk to yourself. The pain is minimal. What is your heter not to have to do that? Right? It's only for organs that we give you a way out, because organs put you in a certain measure of danger. Now, I know that the kidney donor community will actually claim that giving a kidney does not put you in danger. And the truth is, I don't want to suggest it's a very significant danger. Things can be monitored. But still, obviously, if God gave you two kidneys, you are better off with two than one. And there are certain risks in overstressing a kidney that might, in the long run, be very detrimental and even potentially life-threatening as well. Okay? So that is what we call live organ donors. Yeah?
So she mentioned, like, for, like, reincarnation, for example, that, like, your body, because it, like, disintegrates in the ground, there's no way it could, like, come back with everything. But then a rabbi today was saying that, like, when we're reincarnated, we come back the way we were, like, right before we died. Like, even if it was, like, God forbid, left, like, half an arm or something.
That's what you're... Well, you know, there are different sources. We don't have I have to say that although reincarnation is an idea that the Kabbalists developed,
right.
But let me remind you, it's not in the Torah and it's not even in the Talmud. Uh-huh. It's an idea of the Kabbalah. And there are different views, meaning reincarnation is a very accepted view. Mm-hmm. So I agree it's an accepted view. But the particular details of how you come back are murky. And I don't think there can be a definitive position. I think it would almost be a little perverse, I think, to say you come back missing your arm.
Like if how you died, like without an arm, like that's how you would come back. So I'm saying, like,
Let me clarify. Yeah, right. As we're talking, I realize that. Yeah, let me talk. There are two different concepts here. Let's be sure we're differentiating them. There is what is called resurrection of the dead at the end of days. Now, that is fundamental. That is a fundamental principle that is in the Bible and in the Talmud, that at the end of days, we will come back in our bodies. Now, there's a Kabbalistic idea that even until that final resurrection, we get reincarnated multiple times till our soul has done its mission. Okay. Now, with respect to that reincarnation, you come back as a different person. You don't even look the same. And I mean, a man might be a woman might be a man, etc. So you're not talking about reincarnation. You're talking about resurrection.
Yeah.
No. I think that then I'm pretty confident it's the opposite. Resurrection of the dead, you come back healthy and whole. That I think is very clear.
So even if your organs were given to somebody else, you're going to have...
Yes, but I'll get to that because that's correct. Okay,
sorry.
Now... So category one, so be sure, again, I apologize for being confused by the terminology. There's reincarnation and there is resurrection. These are two different processes. Okay, now there is an interesting question. If you were reincarnated in five different bodies, which one do you get at resurrection? That is also a very excellent question. Do I say your soul gets split and all five come back? Or is it only the last one where you accomplished your mission and the other ones are kind of gone? But that creates real complications with marriages. Because let's say, because husband and wife are not always in the same number of reincarnations. Let's say that a man marries his wife, and this is really her last reincarnation because she's perfect. She's perfected herself.
I thought she's never reincarnated for herself. She's only reincarnated to help the soulmate.
Yeah, but which soulmate? In other words...
There's only one... Okay.
Well, I understand. Maybe there's only one soul, but it may have different manifestations of bodies, right? Okay, so they're complicated. Hashem has to work all of this out. This is a complicated process.
I hope he looks this up.
That's right. Amen. But anyway.
Amen.
Okay, so now, category number two, which again is not Rabbi Berman's talk, is what I will call cadaveric organ donors, meaning to say you're taking it from a dead body that's ready to go into the ground. It's cold. Now, most organs you cannot harvest from a real cadaver. For example, a heart is not suitable because the heart disintegrates. We're talking about stone cold, ready to go to the funeral. But some things you could. You could harvest skin, because skin can be preserved for a while. Eyes, right? Eye banks, and the like. Is there a problem with cadaveric organ harvesting? So people often say, well, you can't really harvest organs from dead bodies because, number one, Judaism is against autopsies, which is true. Judaism is against cremation, which is true. We believe in resurrection of the dead, which is true. And if you cut into bodies, you know, you're taking away organs that may be necessary for resurrection. All of these principles are true, but they are not a real problem. And the reason they're not a real problem is that although it's forbidden to desecrate the dead, and it's forbidden to cremate, and it's forbidden to do autopsies, but if what you're doing can save a life, the same way you can violate Shabbos to save a life, you can violate kosher to save a life, you can violate the laws against disrespect to dead bodies in order to save a life. And if you're going to ask me, but what about resurrection of the dead? Well, the answer is exactly as you said. Either way, the body, by the time resurrection happens, the body will be long disintegrated. And Techiyat HaMesim, resurrection of the dead, is a miraculous, supernatural process. I mean, what about the people in the Holocaust? I mean, cremation is a big sin. Obviously, cremation is a sin. But the people who were involuntarily cremated, they committed no sin. They died as Jews. They died sanctifying God's name. Is somebody going to say, God forbid, it would be horrendous to even think such a thing, that because they were cremated, they're not going to have resurrection of the dead? That's absurd. That's impossible. The answer is, God's going to make a miracle, right? So, if you're following halacha, if you're doing God's will in saving a life, the fact that you're cutting into a dead body, that's not a problem. God will give it back to you. In fact, this might even be what the Bible means when it says, God will give you a new heart. Again, it normally means spiritually, but maybe it means he'll give you a new heart. So, the problem with organ donation is not desecration of the corpse, and it is not resurrection of the dead. All of that Hashem is going to fix. But the key problem is, when is a person dead? That is absolutely the key issue of organ donor. And let me explain this first, giving you some secular legal background, both in Israel and the United States, other countries, and then we're going to move to halacha and how halacha integrates it. If you were to look 100 years ago, not even 100, 50 years ago, in a legal dictionary, when is a person dead? That's important. You know, when do I bury you, or when do I have to wait? So the legal definition of death used to be, a person is dead when there is an irreversible, underline irreversible, meaning you can't change it, an irreversible cessation of vital functions, life-giving functions, including respiration and circulation of blood. Those were the two primary vital signs. Breathing, oxygen intake, and circulation of blood as measured by heartbeat and pulse. When those two things were gone and they couldn't be started again by resuscitation, you are legally dead at that point. Now, if you worked with that traditional definition, and that was the legal definition of death, legal, not yet halacha, the legal definition of death for really 1,000 years, heart transplants would have been generally impossible. Because the reason is that once a person has irreversible cessation of both respiration and circulation of blood, the heart muscle atrophies very, very quickly, within a few moments, and it is not suitable for transplantation. So if you have to wait until you have a cadaver that is cold, you will not be able to harvest the heart. So how do heart transplants work? Heart transplants work through a legal redefinition of what is death. And this legal redefinition did not start until the late 1960s, early 1970s. Some of you, the older people might remember the first heart transplant. This was in 1967, I think it was. It was Dr. Christian Barnard in South Africa, Cape Town, South Africa. In those days, by the way, the people that got the hearts, they died more quickly than they would without the operation. I mean, they're only doing it on people who are very close to death, but the guy would die in 3 days. Instead, he died in 2 days. But, it was worth taking the gamble because maybe it would help. So, but in the early days, the recipients of hearts were dying more quickly than they would without it. But eventually, there's a learning curve that's been established, and heart transplants are relatively successful. They could keep people alive for a year, 2 years, even up to 5 years sometimes. 5 years is nothing to laugh at. I mean, it's a very significant additional time that a person can have. But you understand, this is very important, you understand that under the traditional definition of death, a heart transplant would be murder, because in order to do a heart transplant, you cannot wait until irreversible cessation of respiratory and circulatory functions, because the heart would atrophy. So what was developed in the late 60s, early 70s, initially based on a Harvard University definition of irreversible coma, not death, but it then became a death definition, is a concept that is known as brain death. Now here, remember the following. brain death does not mean a person is in a coma or a person is unconscious. That is called a persistent vegetative state. And just because a person doesn't have higher mental consciousness, their brain stem could still be working and controlling digestion, controlling respiration and the like. Terry Schiavo, you may recall a few years ago, was a woman, a very unfortunate case. She was in a coma for 15 years. But Terry Schiavo was not brain dead. She was not on a respirator. She was breathing on her own because her brain stem was intact. If you kill a person in a coma, you are absolutely committing murder. I'm talking about secular law here. 100%. That is not brain death. But brain death is a neurological state where even the brain stem has been destroyed. As a result, there is no respiratory capacity. Oxygen is just being supplied totally mechanically by a ventilator, by a respirator. There is no sensation to stimuli. So you take a needle and you jab it in the arm. There is no response. The pupils do not dilate. You shine a light in the eyes. The pupils don't respond. The brain, in other words, it's not just a coma. The entire brain, including the brain stem, is not functioning. Now, the question you'll ask is, well, if the brain is totally destroyed, then how could the heart still be beating? The answer is, interestingly enough, that to some level, the heart is not directly controlled by the brain. The heart has its own pacemaker. By that I mean, as long as oxygen is being supplied to the heart muscle, even if it's mechanical, for at least a certain amount of time, the heart continues to beat. Now, what the legal definition of death has become in all 50 of the United States and in many European countries, Israel is a bit of a problem here, I'll get to Israel, is a patient can, or a person can be declared dead when there's a neurological diagnosis of clinical brain death. Now, based on brain death, since we can then keep a brain dead person breathing, I don't want to say alive because that begs the question, but we keep them breathing, so the heart muscle, the pacemaker, is able to be activated, we then cut into a person with a beating heart, and we transfer the organ. So the point I'm making is, until very recently, I'll talk about some changes in this, organ donation of hearts was impossible under the classical definition of death. It could only be done with a redefinition of death based on brain death. So the ideal organ donor is a healthy teenager who rides a motorcycle without a helmet. Because what you want for your ideal organ donor is a smashed head, but an intact body. In fact, this must be somewhat of a macabre joke. I understand that when the story I heard, but again, I really don't think it's true. But the story I heard was when some state was debating whether to require a mandatory helmet for motorcycles. So the story was reported that the organ donor lobby was opposed to a mandatory helmet law because they said it would cut down on the number of eligible donors. Now, again, I believe that was probably an attack on organ donors. I don't think they seriously kind of hope people will smash their brains and the like. But here is the thing I want to bring out. I want to bring out that if you go back and you trace the rise of heart transplants and the legislative enactment of brain death laws, you will see their lockstep. The more organ donations get successful, the more states change their laws. Now, I hope you can see that that is already an ethically questionable type of process, because what you're doing is you're changing a definition in order to achieve a result. Meaning, under the old definition of death, I couldn't take the organ because I was murdering the donor. But under the new definition of death, he's already dead, so I'm not murdering him. So we want to do something that's helpful, but we can't do it under the old definition because it's murder. So let's just say it's not murder. You know, if I could quote a very unlikely source, and I did not see this, I read it. This is the cartoon South Park. God forgive me. Okay. But in South Park, they were discussing about how a teacher just wanted to kill a kid who was always...
Kenny.
Who was always, I don't know, whoever it was. Okay, you see, remember who was Mr. So, now he knew that it was against the law to kill a kid, but he said, you know, why don't we just describe this as a late-term abortion in the 250th month? You know, and if we call it an abortion, it's okay, right? So you're kind of answering ethical problems by redefining terms. Actually, this may be a joke on South Park, but as respected a person as James Watson, James Watson was the co-discoverer of DNA, very, very eminent scientist, but he became a little crackpot when he'd speak about other areas. He once suggested that how do we deal with problems of genetic, you know, children that are born with serious genetic defects. Now, if we catch it before they're born through amniocentesis, society permits, not halacha, but society permits abortion. But what if we didn't catch it and the child is born? We're kind of stuck. I mean, this is him talking. So he said, so I'll tell you what. If society draws the line, abortion is okay. Again, this is not halacha. But abortion is okay. Infanticide is not okay. Why don't we just redefine birth so that early cases of infanticide could be called late-term abortions? Mm-hmm. And he suggested birth should be defined as something that happens 72 hours after the emergence of the from the womb. So therefore, if you kill a baby within 3 days, we'll call it an abortion. Now, obviously, that's not changing the reality. You know, Humpty Dumpty says in Alice in Wonderland, words mean whatever I want them to mean. I mean, what are you going to say? You're going to say, "Oh, I treat you as a fetus, therefore I can kill you." I mean, that doesn't change the reality. But subtly, that's what happens. We redefine our terms to permit certain results that wouldn't be permitted otherwise. Again, I'm still speaking secularly. That is exactly what happened with brain death. It was a redefinition of death to facilitate a noble result of saving lives, but nevertheless, it was redefining a term. It was saying that what was murder of a human being yesterday is no longer murder because we now declare that person to be dead. Right? Legislative redefinition of death to facilitate organ transplantation. I would have been much happier with the process had there been an independent decision to define death a certain way, as opposed to the fact that it walks in tandem as a facilitator of organ donation. You really have a problem of a result-oriented jurisprudence. And by the way, this is a process that goes on all the time. This is how the Germans justified killing Jews. How do you justify killing Jews? I mean, you're a normal civilized... I mean, some of the Nazis were pathological and psychopaths, but some of them were normal people who did this job. Now, how do you justify... You know, you get up in the morning. How do you justify mass murder? One of the ways you justify is by training yourself to look at them as subhuman, looking at the Jews like vermin, looking at the Jews as rodents, looking at the Jews as rats that happen to look at human beings. This is a process of psychological brainwashing that allows a person to look at what they're doing, not seeing the evil of what they're doing, because you dehumanize. To some extent, and God forbid, I am not comparing the United States with a Nazi Germany, but that is what the United States did with the Japanese in World War II. The same way, if you look at propaganda posters from World War II, the Japanese were often portrayed as kind of not really human, kind of rodent-like or insect-like. Because you see, when you're doing something that is fundamentally immoral, you gotta kind of have to redefine it in a way that you can live with. But that's artificial. That doesn't change the morality or immorality of what you're doing, but it gives you a bit of a comfort zone. Right? That's how a Nazi could say, well, I'm not really killing humans, I'm killing subhumans, and therefore they look like humans, but I'm doing something good. Yeah.
I'm just curious how being brain dead doesn't fit into the first definition. Because if you have irreversible damage to your respiratory system, ventilator is making you breathe.
Yes.
So there is damage.
Yes, but here's the problem. The problem with brain death is this. Although you're 100% correct, that by definition, there is irreversible destruction of the respiratory system. Because if the brain stem is destroyed, then your lungs do not inflate naturally and the breathing is only artificial. But the circulatory system, through the artificial oxygen, the circulatory system is functioning naturally, meaning naturally in the sense that this is not a heart-lung machine. The heart is actually pumping based on its own pacemaker. Now, that doesn't happen indefinitely. The relationship of the heart to the brain is a little complicated, because unlike regular comas, where a person could be in a coma for 20 years or even longer, you cannot remain in a brain dead state that long. Meaning to say, I believe that the maximum we have for someone that had a clinical diagnosis of brain death until irreversible cardiac arrest is 6 months. So you are talking about, at most, a relatively short period of time. So at some point, the disconnect between the brain and the heart is going to cause cardiac arrest. But at least in the short term, the heart is pumping on its own and circulating blood. Yeah.
Is there zero overlap, like even for 2 minutes after cardiac arrest, that the heart is still a viable heart that could be used, or is zero?
It's like 30 seconds. It's very, 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 very short. Now let me point out the following. So legally, again, I'll mention halacha in a moment. Legally, in all 50 states, brain death is, and in most of Europe, brain death is the legally accepted definition of death, and as a result, provided there is requisite consent, we can remove those organs. The halachic question that is 100%, the difficult question is, does halacha accept brain death as an operative definition of death? If halacha accepts brain death as death, organ donation is a mitzvah, because you're cutting into a dead person to save a live person. That's a mitzvah. And as I say, the problem of autopsies and resurrection of the dead is not a problem when you're doing it to save a life. If, on the other hand, halacha does not accept brain death as death, then when you remove the heart from a brain dead donor whose heart is still beating, you are murdering one person to save another person. And halacha absolutely says you cannot kill A to save B. And even if A is unconscious and A is never going to get better, and B is a person who's young and potentially strong, it makes no difference. You cannot kill. This is the axiom. You cannot kill one person to save another person. The question is exactly this. When you take a heart from a brain dead donor who has not yet had cardiac arrest, are you committing murder? Are you not committing murder? Now, Robby Berman has given you all of the sources, I think, primarily to establish that halacha does accept brain death as death, but some of the sources do not bear out his conclusion. Let me give you a very, very brief summary. Again, to go over the sources at great length would not be that constructive. There is one Mishnah that does lend support to a brain death concept. And that is, the Mishnah is not talking about humans, it is actually talking about animals. And the Mishnah talks about decapitation. That when you sever the head off an animal, even though the animal is still convulsing, there's neurological convulsions, the animal is treated as halachically dead, because since it is severed from its brain, it is no longer treated as alive. Right now, you've seen by the chicken without the head still jumps around and the like. So people like Berman, but actually not him, there's some rabbis have argued that if you see that actual decapitation is equal to death, even when there's still neurological activity, he wanted to describe brain death, a very interesting expression, as physiological decapitation. Do you see the connection? The head is physically, the brain is physically connected to the body, but it's no longer functioning. So the argument would be, brain death might be equated to physiological decapitation. And if anatomical decapitation is sufficient to establish death, meaning physically removing the brain, then perhaps functionality, in other words, physiological lack of function of the brain, ought to be equivalent. That is one argument for the brain death site. On the other hand, a counter argument, oh yes, and a second argument for the brain death side is that the Torah describes the creation of man as God breathed into man the spirit of life. And therefore it is breathing that is described as the prototypical definition of life. And a brain dead person, by definition, does not have a respiratory capacity. But of course, I'll ask you a question on that. Well, what about an ALS patient in advanced stages of Lou Gehrig's disease? He also does not have a respiratory capacity. He might be conscious, he might be able to talk, but his breathing will be totally mechanical. So you have to be careful not to prove too much here. If you're going to argue that anyone that doesn't have respiratory capacity is halachically dead, you wouldn't be just describing as dead brain dead people, you might be describing ALS people as well, which I think even Robbie Berman would not be willing to do.
And many previous.
That's correct. That's correct. Well, yeah, but there, okay, but there the issue is if it's reversible, okay, reversible, right? We're always talking about irreversible. Anything reversible is never a sign of death. Okay, now, let me give you a counter proof. The counter argument is that when the Torah, you know, Jews don't eat blood. Right, we don't eat blood. Everyone knows that Jews do not eat blood. That we have to salt our meat to get rid of the blood, etc. But when the Torah says we don't eat blood, because it says blood is the life force. Blood is the nefesh. The nefesh is the animal soul. You know from your Hasidic studies that kind of keeps me biologically alive, and that seems to suggest it is circulation of blood that is a key definer of life. So, all I'm saying is that there is a massive, massive argument among rabbis based on this and many more complicated Talmudic texts. If the determination of life is based on the brain stem integrating respiratory and other functions, or is it based on circulation of blood? Now, if that means that there's a machlokes here, machlokes means an argument, then potentially removing an organ might be an act of murder, and it could not be countenanced. So here we have a choice here. If we assume that this is a question, an unresolved halachic question, is it better to remove the organ and possibly commit murder? Or is it better not to remove the organ, and although I'm passively causing the recipient to die, at least I'm not actively doing murder? Now, I understand this is a gut-wrenching question, because either way somebody's going to die. But morally, it is better to let somebody die than to kill somebody actively. I mean, we do differentiate between active murder and not helping somebody who could have been helped. So if we knew that the donor would be dead, certainly we would say, go ahead and take the organ. But if you might be murdering the donor, then caution would indicate a sense of passivity, of not intervening. And that is why I have to say that when the jury is out, most of the great poskim have not been in favor of the donation of vital organs, but for two different reasons. Reason number one is, do we accept brain death? That's the reason I just gave you. But there's a reason number two, which has some clinical support, and that is, even if we do accept brain death as a concept, there are those that have argued, and even physicians have argued, that present clinical diagnosis of what we call brain death is not a true destruction of the brain. That's a separate argument, meaning brain death didn't happen. And the proof that they have, and this is very interesting, is they point out that people with a diagnosis of clinical brain death have body temperature. They're warm to the touch. Now, body temperature is controlled by the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is part of the brain. So you can't be truly brain dead if you have body temperature. Moreover, it's been pointed out, and we have studies, we actually have cases like this, women who are brain dead but carried on respirators have been able to bring babies to term. Now, it seems intuitively unlikely, although intuition is not necessarily a proof, that someone that's dead could continue to nurture a baby. I mean, the fact that there can still be bringing a baby to term. And finally, this is anecdotal, there have been some cases of a misdiagnosis of brain death, meaning these are scary cases. And there was a teenager, and okay, these are anecdotal, and maybe it's only one in a million, but it did happen. And if you're the one in the million, you would be a little concerned with this. There was a teenager who was diagnosed as brain dead. They shut off the respirator, and the parents consented for the removal of vital organs. So they're about to take out his heart. And the kid wakes up.
Oh my gosh.
Now, it is impossible to wake up from brain death. If a person has true brain death, that is an irreversible state. But the answer must have been that the diagnosis was not correct. Now, I'm not going to be alarmist and say that, you know, in every case like that, I mean, listen, we have people waking up at funerals, at their own funerals. You can even go to YouTube and see some videos like that. The guy's about to be buried, and he's knocking in the coffin, you know. Get me out of here, you know, and the like. In fact, in Victorian England, I don't want to scare you, in Victorian England, they used to put every grave had a string and a bell so you could ring the bell, you know, just in case. And
the donor,
yeah. Right. My own grave. Oh my God.
Yeah, that's yeah. All right. So the point I'm making is, and again, I will not deny absolutely. Rabbi is 100% correct that there are rabbis who have endorsed organ donation, and they have said halacha recognizes the legitimacy of brain death. But I have to say, again, it's always hard to measure stature, but the greater rabbis have basically said that the issue of potential murder is such a grave issue, that as important as it is to save a life, it is very important to save a life, but it's a much bigger sin to actively murder somebody than to simply not save a person. So if you're not sure if you're involved in this issue of murder, you have to err on the side of caution, and therefore they would not be in favor of the vital organ donors like hearts and the like. Now, let me mention the following, though. First of all, this issue of brain death, in some ways, Baruch Hashem, because of technological developments, may be likely to become less important. You know, there's a major problem in society, forget about halacha for a moment, that there is a tremendous, even if you rely on brain death, there's a tremendous shortage of donor organs. There's just not enough to go around. The demand is much greater than the supply. So people are looking for alternative ways of creating organs. People are going back to animal transplants, which require genetic modification, etc. And by the way, a Jew is allowed to get a pig's heart. That's not a kashrut problem, and the like. But one of the things that has the most promise is through cloning and stem cell research, we might be able to create complete organ systems. Now, this is quite amazing. We already know from stem cells, right? We have, let's say, egg and sperm, IVF, and in the initial weeks before there's cell specialization, we can harvest stem cells, and we can then convert those stem cells into any one of over 200 specific cellular types. We've already had great success in producing heart valve tissue from stem cells. Not even embryonic stem cells, even from adult stem cells. Heart valve. Now, in theory, we're not there yet, but in theory, there is no reason why we can't use stem cells to create organs. If I can create heart valve tissue, why can't I create a heart? Now, it is much more complicated, but theoretically, if we could use stem cells to generate hearts, we would create hearts. And they would not be artificial hearts, they would be natural hearts. Moreover, we can actually create a heart from the stem cells of the recipient himself. Right, the recipient needs a heart transplant. We can take a somatic, we can take either stem cells from his bone marrow, or we could take a somatic cell and through a cloning process, somatic cell, meaning we take a skin cell, whatever it is, we can create a heart out of a skin cell. Because remember, every single cell of your body has the entire genetic code, except when it became a skin cell, the other DNA got shut off. But if you take that somatic cell and you put it into a denucleized egg, right, you're familiar with the cloning process, in a sense, you now generate stem cells, which can then turn entire. So you can create a heart, in theory, you can create a heart from a skin cell. So if I could create a heart from the donor's own somatic cells, so look at what that solves. That solves, number one, the ethical problem of brain death. Number two, it solves the shortage of donor organs. And number three, it solves the problem of rejection, because I could create something that is genetically identical.
But that brain death would be the only way that a human could die, because technically all organs could be replaced.
Well, let me put it this way. Well, okay, that's an interesting question. Once a person goes into cardiac arrest, I don't have to bring them back to life, you know. But and not everybody could take an organ anyway. In other words, you're never going to have 100% with organs. I mean, it's not just rejection. Now, there is a little bit of a circular problem, though, because given the fact that a lot of illnesses are genetically based, so when you create a genetic duplicate of this guy's existing heart, you might be giving him back a bad heart. But even so, if it takes X number of years, you know, so he's going to get X number of years until something happens. So in some ways, we're not going to have to worry about brain death if we ever develop the technology, and there's no reason why we can't, because it's really in that direction of creating hearts or organ systems through stem cells and even through cloning, which will give you the genetic double. That's one thing. But let me mention another protocol that was developed in the University of Pittsburgh. And this sounds at first like something useful, a panacea, but it really is much worse than even brain death. Yeah.
Was this only secular? Like, what does Jewish law consider?
Jewish law would be 100% in favor of this.
Of making a cloning to get another.
Of doing what? Of.
Like taking a bit of.
Yes. That's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, Jewish law would permit the creation of hearts by taking stem cells and creating organ systems. That would be absolutely permitted. The only halachic problem might be that if you have an embryo and you have to destroy the embryo to get the stem cells, the issue might be abortion. But even then, maybe I should give you another share on that. Most opinions say until an embryo is in a woman's womb, there's no abortion law against it. So you can harvest the stem cells to make organ systems. So this would be a wonderful thing. This would prevent the whole brain dead problem. Now, another way, which is a more modest way, but a very important way, is if we could develop methods of organ preservation after cardiac arrest, we could wait until classical death, person's dead, and then we could find ways of preserving. I mean, the problem is the organ deteriorates so rapidly, but if we could have improvements in organ preservation, even if it would just be a few minutes, that itself could allow us to move away. Now, let me just mention a protocol that was developed in the University of Pittsburgh. And they were concerned with all of the problems people were raising about brain death, and they don't want to cut into a body when the heart is still beating because they might be killing somebody. So they invented something that's called NH, non-heart beating, NHBP. NHBP, non-heart beating protocol. Non-heart beating protocol. And what they do is essentially is this. Imagine you have a patient who's not brain dead. He's not brain dead. His brain is functioning, but he's very sick, and he's dying, and he's being kept alive. He's not brain dead. I mean, there are many people on respirators who are not brain dead, but they need respiratory assistance and hydration and nutrition, right? So he's just a person who's very close to death. It's a little macabre. So we have two teams of doctors. Team number one are the doctors taking care of him. Team number two are waiting for him to die so they could give his heart to a guy there. Now, the person has directed that through a living will or whatever it is, that life support be terminated. So what they do is, they terminate life support, they count to 10, literally, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, he's not breathing, his heart is not beating, they remove the heart, and they transplant, and they say they're not relying on brain death, they're relying on the fact that his heart stopped beating, they're relying on cardiac arrest. And therefore their argument is, we are not taking the heart until there's cardiac arrest, and it's simply a time to death where the transplantation can occur immediately in the next room and the like. Now, it's a little macabre. It's like having the vulture standing over you waiting, but that's what they do. Now, their argument is that we are taking the heart only after the heart stopped beating within, you know, 10 seconds. But here is your problem. In a way, this is worse than brain death, because remember that even cardiac arrest is death only when it is irreversible. Now, within around 2 minutes, there is a potential, number one, of auto-resuscitation. Sometimes the heart starts again within 2 minutes. And certainly if you intervene with CPR, you could start the heart, you know, within a few minutes. So if you want to rely on cardiac arrest to establish death, you have to wait until it is irreversible. And that paints you into a corner, because the amount of time you have to wait to establish the irreversibility of cardiac arrest would make that transplantation impossible. So essentially, what the University of Pittsburgh is doing is, it is removing a heart based on a reversible cardiac arrest. And that's even more problematical than brain death, because brain death, at least, is an irreversible status of the destruction of the brain. Here, you are relying on a reversible cessation of heartbeat based on timing the death. So I would have to say, again?
Do those people also have brain death, or not necessarily?
They're not brain dead. That's what they're saying. They're saying it's just a timed disconnection of life support. Yeah. They count to 10 or 20, and they cut in. Problem is, and they're boasting, so you see, we remove organs based on cardiac arrest, because the patient goes into cardiac arrest right after the life support is removed. But the problem is, it's a reversible cardiac arrest, so you can't proclaim death based on that. So there are problems in this to be considered, that the non-heartbeating protocols are not an improvement over brain death. And even, I'm not sure if Robbie spoke about this, but I think even Robbie might be against that, because without a diagnosis of brain death, you cannot declare a person dead because their heart stopped if it could be resuscitated and revived. Now, let me mention one final question that's very important. I think Robbie probably used this. The reason I come from him, I do know him, and we've actually, I don't call it debate, I don't like to debate per se, but you know, we've had discussions and the like. And again, I respect his point of view, and I assume he told you the story of how he got involved in this. Did he tell you that there was a young woman who was studying in Israel, Elisa Flatto, and she was a victim of terrorism. She was on a bus, and the bus blew up. I think she was 20 years old, and she died tragically. And her parents did make the decision to donate all of her organs to different people. And I think her different organs were donated to 5 different people who benefited from them. And again, it was an act of kindness on the part of her parents to try to save lives, even as a result of this awful tragedy. So I think they asked Robbie to kind of organize a campaign to encourage this in the Jewish community. So, you know, it always puts people like me in a very uncomfortable position, because it's like, it's not, you know, it sounds like I'm against saving lives or I'm against helping people. That's not the issue, because again, I very much respect the compassion that motivates people to do this. But once again, you do have to consider the other side of potentially murdering somebody, and that's a very, very grave, grave concern. It is not the concern of resurrection of the dead or those other things that we can live with. It is the concern for murder. So now let me mention a final aspect of this. Yeah?
Also, to me, like, your reason for suicide, like, you would buy a lottery ticket,
ticket with the knowledge that you would win the lottery, and the likelihood that you'd be killing somebody if they're not in the state, if they're brain dead.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it seems so improbable that being opposed to it is the same reasoning as buying a lottery ticket with the assumption that you're going to win the lottery.
Well, no. I see. I'm not sure why you say that, because in order to make a statement. That to say that somebody who's brain dead is alive is highly illogical. That would very much depend on your definition of death, right? And here's the critical thing that people have to know. A definition of death is not a medical or scientific question. A doctor can describe a state. A doctor can describe when you're in this state, you can do this, you can't do this. But whether we call that dead or alive is a religious and moral question. You see, for example, you tell me a brain dead person you want to say is dead, but a person in a coma is not dead, even though there's a lack of consciousness, right? Because the brain stem is there. What about an anencephalic baby? That means a baby that's born without a frontal brain, only a brain stem. Do you know that there was a proposal by some doctors around 15 years ago, it was withdrawn, that we ought to be able to take organs from anencephalic babies because they should not be considered alive. And then, of course, you get into severe Alzheimer's, meaning there is a real slippery slope type of issue once you start defining people as dead or alive based on the functionality of their brain. So that's the issue. And then, as I indicated, even brain death is a bit of a misnomer, because there are some residual brain functions that in fact are carried out, such as temperature control, some thyroid, and the like. So yes, they don't respond to pain, and their pupils don't dilate. So it's not, you know, unless you have a fundamental definition. Now, I could tell you spiritually, death is when the soul leaves the body. That's great, and that's fine, and that's true. But the problem is, we only know that by physiological states, and the question is, how do we define them?
What should be on a Jewish person's will to stop life support or keep it?
Okay, so that's really a separate question, but as a general rule, we believe that you try to prolong life as long as you can, unless there is extreme pain and suffering. And when there's extreme pain and suffering, you are permitted to have the discontinuation of what you might call extraordinary and invasive treatment. Now, halacha is not in favor of starvation. You need to continue to get food and water until the time that it overwhelms your system and you can't process it, which is very much towards the end. But you could decline chemotherapy, you could decline surgery, you could decline prolonging yourself in extreme pain. But generally speaking, in the absence of severe pain, we believe that there is a mitzvah to try to stay alive, even if you seem not to be able to function very well. Because every second that the soul is in earth, it is accomplishing a mission. I mean, it's hard for us to understand, because we're used to measuring life in terms of productivity. And when a person's productivity is impaired, we think life is not worth it. I'll give you a little example. I had a relative in my family. They had a little boy, a beautiful little boy, who died of leukemia at the age of 4. Very, very sweet boy. And you may know, if you've been familiar with this, that certainly within the religious communities, when a child is sick, you have literally thousands and thousands of people. They say prayers, they give charity, they learn Torah, they do all sorts of mitzvos that it should be for the healing of this child. And a person might think, well, you know, a child dies at 4 and he suffered. Like, what was the purpose of his life? Wouldn't it have been better if he never would have been born? Like, why was he born to live such a life? But, you know, he goes up to God, and let's say God asks him, you know, so to speak, I'm just reconstructing a conversation, well, what did you do with your life? And he says, because of me, thousands and thousands of people did all of these commandments. It might be that the 4-year-old accomplished more in his life than many people might accomplish in 70 years. You see, it's a big mistake when we think that the only thing that matters in the world is what we do. Sometimes our goal in life is to become transformative in the lives of others. So the person in the coma, the person with Alzheimer's, they are serving a function in teaching us how to behave with decency and compassion. And that is their spiritual mission. We don't understand that. That is their spiritual mission. And therefore, there is a mitzvah to try to keep them alive. Now, when their suffering is tremendous, we're not allowed to kill them. Obviously, we do not believe in assisted suicide. But withdrawing, you know, extreme invasive medical treatment might be justified in those cases. But it's only the suffering. So if the person is not suffering, the person's in a coma, or the person is Alzheimer's and the person is relatively benign in their condition, just I'm suffering because I see them, mm-hmm. we generally have to try to keep them alive. Yeah.
But if the person is not undergoing extreme pain but is clearly terminal in the doctors, could they have an advanced directive to avoid going on to the ventilators in the first place because they don't want to be in the position of being like...
Yeah, so here's the thing. Now, legally, of course, any person could write any advance directive that they want, but halachically, generally speaking, we are obligated to initiate aggressive life support unless the person is suffering or will suffer as a result.
Even if it's
excruciating pain.
I guess it's extremely unlikely to benefit.
Well, it depends how you define benefit, meaning if benefit means cure, you're correct. But we understand benefit to mean the prolongation of life itself is a benefit. So if it's going to keep them alive another day, that is considered to be a benefit. Yeah.
What about internally? I understand the concept of externally having to save somebody's issue because of halacha, but if you're willing to sacrifice yourself to save others, is that necessarily against halacha?
Yeah, that's a very excellent question. And that is, you're suggesting an analysis where even if brain death is murder, but if I sign an organ donor card, what I'm basically doing is I am willing to altruistically sacrifice myself to save others. Should I not be allowed to do that? After all, the soldier who goes to war is risking his life to save others. You may recall we have cases in Israel where terrorists come and somebody puts his... Or even in San Diego in the United States, if you remember when When Adam Lanza came to the school to shoot up children, a teacher like stood in the door. In other words, we have all sorts of cases where people volunteer, they give up their life to save others. So that's a very, very excellent point, and that's maybe a different perspective in the sense of looking at organ donation as altruistic, putting yourself in danger, or actually giving up your life to save another. My only answer to that is, as a technical matter of halacha, that would not justify the surgeon doing an act of murder. Meaning to say, you have two different things. I can give up my life, but I can't. But you don't have permission to be the one who kills me, right? So you have that kind of dichotomy. Yeah.
How does halacha define pain and suffering?
Yeah, you know, these are very excellent questions, and I'm assuming your question is the following: is pain and suffering a physical, neurological thing, or does it include psychological anguish? That's a very important question. For example, let's say a person is totally paraplegic, feels no pain at all, and he doesn't want life support because he says the pain is unbearable, the pain of not being able to do anything is so unbearable. Well, In a literalist sense, he's not feeling any pain. He doesn't feel any pain at all. I jab him with a needle, doesn't feel it. So that is a big, big argument, meaning some differentiate between the word pain and the word suffering. And they say pain is a physiological, neurological response. Suffering is the psychological, mental anguish of a devastating life. So that would play a part as well.
I was like talking about more like if someone's like sick and they're like unconscious, how would you know if they're sick?
Oh, okay. Yes. That's also a very excellent question. The truth of the matter is we really don't know what are the mental states of people in deep comas. Not brain dead people, people in persistent vegetative states. What do they feel? What do they know? Do they perhaps even go in and out of some semi-conscious state? It's not always entirely clear. We would need, this is guesswork, frankly, and halacha doesn't have a clear answer to this. This would depend on the medical science. We try to make our best judgments. It is often assumed that people in comas, if they don't appear to be agitated, are in a relatively restful, benign state. But as I say, that might, sometimes there'll be external signs of agitation and pain, and that would be relevant here. But it is a mystery.
Is that do you consider pain and suffering with pain medicine or without?
Okay, so once again, it would appear that if pain can be adequately controlled, then it has to be, you have to utilize the alternatives before you disconnect life support. And I do want to say, again, I hope that none of you have relatives or family members in any difficult situation, but unfortunately these things come up, that one of the great omissions and failures historically of the medical profession, it's gotten a lot better recently, is in pain management. Meaning people developed all sorts of surgeries and all sorts of aggressive interventions, but pain was often ignored. You either were told it's in your head, it's psychosomatic, or I'll give you a very good example. Morphine drips are a very good example. Morphine, or any strong narcotic, can be very effective at controlling pain, but for many, many years, doctors would not give terminal patients morphine prescriptions because they didn't want their patients to become addicted to a narcotic, even though they only have 2 weeks to live. What's the big deal? And there's a morphine pump that patients self-administer, and many doctors said, I can't do that because the guy's going to be a junkie or whatever it's going to be. But it's been found that when patients are in charge of their pain medication, they actually have a lower dosage than a doctor might prescribe in a prescription. So people have been very responsible, and it's been very, very beneficial. So pain management is really a neglected stepchild of Western medicine, and it has all sorts of forms. There is medicine, narcotics, there is biofeedback, there is hypnosis, there is acupuncture, there is Eastern stuff that can work together, alternative medicine that can work together with conventional medicine. So you're right. In fact, the whole movement in the United States and in Canada and in Europe towards physician-assisted suicide, right? There's a movement, unfortunately, that doctors should. It's legal in some states, and Canada now made it compulsory, and in the Netherlands, and in Scandinavia, right? Physician-assisted suicide in Oregon, in Washington State. Now, if you think about this, why are people pushing for this? What is the motivation? Why do people want to have this option of committing suicide? So the studies indicate that people are frightened, they're terrorized of having uncontrollable pain at the end of their lives. And most of the time they're not going to want to take their life, but they want to have that option because they say, if I'm suffering and you can't do anything about it. But the problem is, of course, that there's a lot that we can do, a tremendous amount that we can do, and sometimes we don't do, that can help a person. And I'm not talking about the extreme case of a medically induced coma. In effect, that can solve all pain problems, just knock the person in the coma. But a person might say, well, I don't want to live, for a year in a medically induced coma. I'm talking about things far short of that, which can actually give a person a quality of life and a certain joy of life. Not pain-free, not but
marijuana?
Huh? Well, yeah. I mean, medical marijuana is a very good example. Medical marijuana can help quite a lot. Now, obviously, it can be abused. You start legalizing medical marijuana, get it at a drugstore, you'll get it for your colds or whatever it is, you're going to have problems. But in serious cases, this is why Hashem, why did Hashem create these things? These things have a purpose. Everything in the world has a positive purpose. Snake venom has positive purposes. And marijuana and heroin and morphine have positive purposes. They can be abused, but we shouldn't necessarily preclude them. Now, let me just mention one final question, which I'm very, very sure. I know that Rabbi uses this all the time as one of his rhetorical devices. I'm sure, brought up the idea that there are so many Orthodox Jews in Israel who put themselves on organ recipient lists, and they're willing to take organs, but they don't give organs, and what gives them the right to take if they're not willing to give. This is an argument that's often made. Hey, you know, you're willing to take somebody else's organ, but you're not willing to give your own. That's not...
The organizations say that. Say again. The only,
some organizations say that. In fact, the European community, which is certainly not a friend of Israel in any sense, but they actually want to have a rule that no person can get an organ unless you've signed the ability to donate an organ. Now, you can't get unless you're willing to donate. Now, the truth of the matter is, it's kind of stupid, because when you have an 85-year-old person who needs an organ, he'll say, sure, take... I mean, he has no organs that anyone wants. He'll sign the card and there'll be no problem. That's what's happening, actually. People are signing these authorizations knowing their organs will never be taken in order to receive an organ. But okay, so some people
even
want...
the eyes? I think you could take the eyes.
Yeah, the eyes you could, but they're not requiring the eyes. They're requiring the vital organs. Now, some people want to modify the rule that you have to have signed an organ donor card within 5 years, or I'm sorry, more than 5 years before your need for an organ. All right, so that, okay. So they're trying to they're trying to tweak that. Okay, and a lot of people say it's...
Doesn't a doctor legally have the obligation to do whatever they can to save your life also?
Oh, yes, of course. Well, that's true, unless you have a living will. You can have a living will that says, I don't want life support.
Okay, but if you didn't sign the donor card, and the only way to save a life is to get, then they have to try and do that, or not?
But the question is, if it's murder, they couldn't, right? They can't murder one person to save you, right?
No, but even if the surgeon was willing to put in, I mean, the systems of the places that have the organs are not willing to give it to you.
It's a rule. These are local rules. It's not a hospital. It's not a doctor rule. It's a rule of the associations. So let me just mention what the halacha response to Rabbi's point is. And again, you may not buy it because it may make you ethically uncomfortable, I understand. But it is a technical argument. The technical argument is that we do have an organ procurement system where the supply is much less than the demand. The demand is much higher than the supply. So let's imagine, I'm just going to make up a number, that for every available heart, there are 10 potential people who need to receive it. Now let's say I'm an Orthodox Jew, and I don't believe in donor organ, I believe that removal of the organ is murder. But if I don't put myself on the list, the organ is going to be removed anyway for one of the other 9. So my putting my name on the list is not causing the commission of an act. The evil act, as it were, is going to happen with me or without me. So the halachic argument is, if the evil will occur with me or without me, and my acquiescence is not a cause, I am permitted to benefit to save my own life, as long as I am not the one that is causing. I cannot cause the death of a person. You know, if you remember, if you've watched any legal shows on television, now you may know, there is in American law something called the exclusionary rule. That means if the police violated your rights, they searched your car or they searched your house without a search warrant, and they found evidence, they found drugs, they found a murder weapon, you go free. You cannot be convicted if the evidence they obtained, this is one of the crazy rules of American law, if the evidence they obtained was in violation of your rights, you cannot be convicted no matter how absolute the evidence is. They found a murder weapon, they found a gun, they found a knife dripping blood, they found the drugs. You go free if they got it without a search warrant. That's called the exclusionary rule, which means that the ends don't justify the means, even if it's a good end, if the means were improper. But halacha doesn't necessarily go that far. Halacha basically says, even if it was wrong to take the heart, but if you're not the cause of it, it would have happened anyway, you are allowed to benefit. Now, if there would be a one-to-one correspondence that without you they wouldn't take the heart, then you would not be allowed to put yourself on the list. But this is the justification for what some people consider moral hypocrisy. I do understand the argument, but this would be the technical justification. Yeah?
You're also taking away the chance of someone else getting married.
Well, but that's okay, but you have the same right. You have the same right. I mean, listen, you know, your life is in danger, somebody else's life is in danger. Now, you're not obligated to die so that somebody else will live. I mean, when you have a limited medical resource, you have the same right as anybody else, so you don't have to take yourself off the list.
The only thing I would say to that is it makes perfect sense if there's a non-Jew as part of that 10 that would have been on the list.
Yep.
10 Jews are on that list.
You're 100% correct. Because none of the Jews... You are 100% correct. Indeed, if all of the demand is coming from the Jews, all 10 have to take themselves off the list.
Exactly.
That is correct. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach so ruled, but most of the time, at least in the United States, that's not the case.
Of course.
But you are correct.
You seem like it's valid for a person to want to put themselves on a list, but it also seems understandable for the agency to say sorry.
Well, yes. Listen, the agency is a secular body, and the agency makes decisions based on trying to enhance the supply of organs. So I'm not critical of the agency in that way. But at least if the agency doesn't have that rule, I am permitted to put myself on the list. Yeah.
The story you told us at the beginning of class about the child who could have received an organ from their sibling.
Yeah.
And then also the later example you used about how in law there's exceptions. Like, for instance, when you have fruit from a poisonous tree evidence. I mean, there's exceptions to every single law and every single technical definition. So how can this, like, be approached in a way that it's a legal issue when I would feel that every single issue is personal? And there isn't really an application of law that's universal. I mean, you can say that every situation is unique, so how can there be, like, a universal definition?
Well, now, which definition are you questioning right now? When you think, how
the entire definition of what's dead and why it wouldn't be permitted.
Well, you know, I hope that I wasn't suggesting that every single thing is subjective. I think there can be universal definitions. I think something like dead or alive is something that will have a uniform definition. I think it's inconceivable if you have two people who have the identical medical condition, and say, well, based on your situation, you're dead, and based on your situation, you're alive. It all depends on your question, meaning to say the following. When you're asking a question like, is something for the benefit of a child or not for the benefit of a child, that is an individual tailor. In other words, any legal system, halacha or law, raises questions that are sometimes objectifiably verifiable or at least answerable, and sometimes are very subjective in their nature. So in the earlier situation of taking the organ from the 11-year-old, the question is this considered a benefit for only the older brother, or is it also a benefit for the younger brother? Those are fact-sensitive, individual, tailor-made types of problems. But some other types of issues, is brain death death? I don't think is that type of question, because if it is, it's death for everybody, and if it's not, it's death for nobody. So all I can tell you is, there are questions and there are questions. Some types of questions are those that will vary with the circumstances, and some types of questions are more objective.
Personally, it just seems so antisocial because, I mean, it just in politics, when you look at what makes a political system work, is people wanting to uphold the rule of law, wanting to be good people, not wanting to murder each other on
the
street. And it's the same thing with the organ donation. I mean, of course you can receive a donation when you need it, but then, I mean, on the other hand, you should also be willing to give. I mean, that's how society works. It's take, and even if it's against religious law, who are we to say it's against religious law?
Again. I mean, I could use your very terms and make the following argument. I am not asking anybody to accept my religion. I'm just following my religion. In other words, my religion says I cannot donate organs. I'm not telling I'm not telling a non-Jew how to behave. So in a sense, this is exactly what's happening. I'm following my religion, and I'm taking advantage of the society that follows their values. I mean, I understand it sounds a little selfish, but in a sense, this is certainly not coercive, because any person who makes a decision not to donate an organ is making their decision based on their religion. They're not asking society to pass a law to prohibit organ donation. They are simply saying, my religion doesn't allow me to do it. So in a sense, everybody is doing their own thing here. The only argument is, and you're saying that it lacks a certain sense of social compassion. And I agree. I understand the rhetorical power of the argument. But again, if we go back to fundamental problems, that brain death might be murder, you know, in a sense, your option is going to be limited. You have to give up a little bit of your social cooperation in order not to commit something that you consider to be a grave moral offense. Okay, anyway, well, thank you. It was a very, very good discussion. I appreciate all of your insights. And is this your last week? Okay, well, it's good having you. And please come back to Israel often. This is...
Do you teach at Stern? I'm thinking about your name.
No, I don't. I don't.
Okay.
Yeah. I think Rabbi Flam teaches at Stern, medical ethics.
Did you ever teach up in Rosenfeld, medical ethics?
Where?
In Rosenfeld and Spahn?
I don't think so.
I feel like a lot of this, my daughter told me, I think she must have been sitting in a class with her, I don't know when.
Maybe, I mean, in Spahn sometimes, and maybe I gave a guest lecture. I wasn't doing it as a regular up there. Okay. You all take care.